Earth Day is this month. Observance of the day began in 1970 as a way to demonstrate support for environmental protection. And its adoption in 192 countries globally was seen as reason for celebration by supporters.
For many environmentalists today, though, it could feel as though Earth Day has lost some of that optimism. Climate change reports predict worst-case scenarios with relatively short timelines. And with a new report turning the focus from stopping climate change to coping with it, it can be tough to be optimistic.
Now, it's undeniable that humans have changed the Earth from things like irrigation to increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere to introducing new plant and animal species around the globe.
Scientists have actually created a word to describe the period in the Earth's history during which humans have affected it, and it goes back a lot further even than the Industrial Revolution. It's called the Anthropocene, and some scientists who study it say that human change to the planet is complicated and it's not necessarily all bad.
Earl Ellis is one of those scientists, and he'll be coming to Madison to speak at the Nelson Institute for Earth Day on April 22nd. He's an associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He joins us now along with Paul Robbins, director of the Nelson Institute. Earl, good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Earl, let's start with what the Anthropocene is. It's a relatively new term coined in the last, I'd say, 5 years or so. Flesh us out. What is it?
Well, basically, it's the proposal put forth originally by Paul Crutzen, who's a Nobel Prize winner in atmospheric chemistry, who was the person who more or less discovered the chemistry behind the ozone hole, that basically brought out the idea that humans have changed the Earth so much, and in his case, he was looking at the atmosphere, that we no longer live under the conditions of this kind of natural environment of the preceding geological time period, the Holocene. And the idea is that we now live in the Anthropocene, this geological epoch in which humans have transformed the Earth system.
And what kind of things are we referring to when we talk about the human change? What kind of changes?
Well, the fact is that you could make a very long list here. We've been changing the planet ever since we wiped out some of the first large megafauna before the last ice age. And we've been changing with agriculture, and increasingly with modern industry, we've introduced a whole host of different types of unprecedented ecological, chemical, physical changes in the Earth system. And of course, we are now changing Earth's climate.
And as far as how that's being digested in the environmental community, what is the prevailing thought been about the Anthropocene era?
Well, I found that the concept has really brought out everybody's kind of personal feeling about humans as alterers of the Earth. Some people see this as the end of the world, with people changing everything. Things have just got to get worse. And then you've got other people who see it as a time potentially of optimism, as we've finally recognized that we are now firmly in the driver's seat. We are changing everything. That now we've recognized this, we may have the chance to actually engage more positively with the environment.
Paul, is it your sense that at this point many environmentalists are on board with the idea that we are living in the Anthropocene era?
Well, I think most environmental activists definitely have long agreed that there's been human impact on the Earth. I think what might make them a little nervous is the notion that we learn to live with that, because they might believe that there's a way to turn back the clock. And on some systems, that's possible, but on a great many others, it's not. So I think the news is still settling on this in certain communities.
And Paul, what would you say are the most sort of significant changes that humans have done to the Earth in this new Anthropocene era?
Well, land cover change is, you know, probably the most recognizable around us. I mean, the movement of species back and forth just between the Americas and the old world after 1492 fundamentally changed all of these landscapes in ways that there's no way to unwind it or unstir the cream out of the coffee. The systems just became incredibly complex and totally new. So they often exhibit ecological novelty, which is simply a term for relationships that had never happened in historical evolution or prehistorical evolution, but which were unwinding in front of us or opening up in front of us. And we see that in places like the romantic places like the Amazon rainforest, but we see it in our own backyards with mixes of all the turf grasses of the United States are introduced exotic invasive species from Europe. So land cover change is, of course, a really big one, and biodiversity decline is another, I think, really important one. We lost a lot of species. This is a reason to worry, I think, but at the same time, there are lots of ways that species that we would think could only thrive in wilderness are thriving in our own backyards. So the glass might very well be half full in terms of the mass extinction we're going through now, or at least drawing the rate of it to something more manageable.
Earl, is the assumption that there are no places on planet Earth now that have been left untouched by humans?
I would say that is overstating the case. There are still places where the evidence of direct human alteration is not there. On the other hand, with climate change, we're affecting those places the most, the places that tend to be the most remote, cold, dry places where people have less of a history. Tend to be affected the most by global climate change. So if you consider climate as one of these effects, then, yeah, you could say that there's no place that's unaltered by humans.
Now, I want to ask you both, you know, we tend to think of humans' impact on the Earth as something that's negative and the Anthropocene as something that is a bellwether of bad things to come. But is it? Is it necessarily a negative thing? Earl, we'll start with you.
Well, I think it really depends on us. And it depends both on what we expect our planet to be like. I mean, do we want a planet with 9 billion people on it that is essentially looking like a planet of 10,000 years ago? I think if you expect this, you're going to be disappointed. On the other hand, I think that the prospects have never been better for humans to act in a more united, more comprehensive, more proactive way to both ensure a better standard of living for people and a healthy environment for non-human species. I think the prospects are actually better than they've ever been in some ways for that. But it's not something that will occur without a great emphasis societally around the world on that kind of an effort. So it's going to be up to us.
So just to follow up on that before we get to Paul, though, is the goal to dial back the clock and go back to something resembling the Holocene or something that has less human imprint, or is it just to be better stewards?
I think the answer is there are some places where we can preserve, to some degree, some of that classic ecological heritage. But I think that the real opportunity here, the thing that's going to really enable us to move forward with environmentalism in the Anthropocene is going to be engaging proactively in stewardship, thinking about what we can make, not what we can stop ourselves from making.
And Paul, let's bring you on this. Do you feel that the Anthropocene is inherently a negative thing?
Oh, no. I mean, I think it actually has all kinds of opportunities built into it. And I think it goes with Earl's notion of crafting or making. We're tinkerers as a species, and we're going to go forward tinkering, but we could do it in a more methodical way and one that pays better attention to our non-human friends out there on the Earth. So I think there's real opportunities to craft the world, admitting that we can't control it. So often we do things that have unintended and really negative impacts, but that doesn't mean that as we go along we can't be aware, adapt, and produce outcomes that are win-win ecologies. That is, ecologies where, you know, you can have production and livelihoods and a quality of life while at the same time having biodiversity and clean air and clean water. These things are possible.
So, Paul, would you say that maybe the part of the main thrust here is that humans need to acknowledge that they are having a larger impact than ever before, but to go forward and maybe bring in some tools that are uniquely human, like innovation and new technologies?
Without question. I think the Anthropocene is really a call to responsibility, in a sense. And that the tools we have, actually, we have lots around us already. There's terrific examples. My team is doing work in India where we see high levels of commodity crop production, stuff like coffee and rubber, things that, you know, you're consuming in your car tires or in your cup every morning. And they managed somehow to cultivate these export crops amidst a tremendous amount of avian and amphibian diversity. And when you get these kinds of species, it means you have healthy ecosystems. And this isn't some traditional backwards community. These are modern, you know, semi-industrial agricultural production systems. It's quite remarkable.
And Earl, what guidance would you want to give to innovators and environmental innovators in particular?
Well, I think that one of the most interesting challenges of our time that I think is people are taking up on this is urbanization. And it may seem to many that urbanization is simply the end of nature when things essentially stop being natural as in the city. Yet, when you really look at it, the fact that people are voluntarily moving from the countryside where they're widely dispersed and have livelihoods that depend on changing the landscape a lot for little gain often, Concentrating in the cities, moving all these people to the cities is actually allowing landscapes to recover in many areas. And by essentially making the city more attractive and more ecologically healthy, and containing some of the negative influences of the city, like pollution, for example, putting all those things together, the draw to the city yet making the city better, is actually one of those opportunities we have right now as very quickly people are making this big move.
We're speaking right now with Earl Ellis and Paul Robbins. Earl Ellis, Associate Professor of Geography and Environmental Systems at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County, and Paul Robbins, Director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, talking with them both about how to approach conservation and the environment in the midst of the Anthropocene, the age of human impact on the globe.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think people need to change the way they think about the environment and environmentalism? Should we take a hands-off approach or embrace a management role? Should we emphasize returning things to the way they were before human impact, or make the best of the way things are now?
We're talking now with Paul Robbins, Director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and Earl Ellis, Associate Professor of Geography and Environmental Systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. They're talking about new ways of approaching environmentalism in the 21st century.
We want to hear from you and what you think about the environment in the Anthropocene era. Do you think that we should focus on restoring nature to what it was before human contact, or make the best of what we have? Are you optimistic, or are you really worried about our planet's environmental future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
And we'll go down to our phone lines and talk to Mark in Ripon. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I am a person who believes that we are being a little too harsh on ourselves here in the United States as far as being overly stringent upon our industry and upon our own personal environment at the expense of forcing our industries overseas where they can pollute at will. So I believe we should do more to curtail the pollution overseas, where it's kind of the not my backyard attitude. We need to extend that to what's going on in places like China. Bring the industry back to this country in a responsible way. The net gain here will increase, but the gross gain worldwide will go down drastically. And if you ever look at a satellite image, you'll see that our weather comes from that direction. So all the pollution that they're producing over there in China is just being rained down upon us.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mark. Got your point there. And let's go to you, Earl. What do you think about that? Do we need to focus more on developing nations and getting them up to speed on good environmental practices and maybe keep domestic businesses here in the United States? Is there a tie in there?
Well, I think from a pure economic point of view, it seems kind of foolish that we've allowed all of our industry basically to be outsourced, and I think Wisconsin is probably a good example of that. From the point of view of the environment, yes, we have exported our industry and a lot of our pollution to other countries, and I think for that reason that has been one of the reasons it's been easier to clean up our air and easier to clean up our water. Because it is challenging to maintain high industrial productivity without pollution. It is possible, but it's more difficult. And by exporting this overseas, it's in a sense been out of sight, out of mind, and folks over there are dealing with a lot of our pollution, in fact. But on the other hand, again, what is the solution? Can we force them not to to develop, in a sense? They are taking advantage of the fact that we are not advancing our own industry. And I think that it's been very good for them in many ways, and I think more power to developing nations to bring people out of poverty. I think what China has done in bringing hundreds of millions of people out of poverty is one of the greatest advances in human society in human history.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Mark. And let's go next to Joseph in La Crosse. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, thank you. I have kind of a shifting perspective, if you will. I've lived in Germany for the last year, and I'm just visiting back here at the moment, but I've spent 20 years here. And I'm curious, one of the problems that Germany is dealing with right now is that they've been so ridiculously successful in creating alternative energy sources that the grid is having trouble accepting them, because they're looking at the potential to generate like 70% of their electricity needs from alternative sources during, you know, beautiful, brilliant, sunny, windy days. And then all of a sudden the sun stops being available and the wind stops blowing, and suddenly creating baseline, sustaining baseline demand is really difficult. And what's happening is, along with the fact that they want to shut down all of the nuclear reactors by 2022, they now burn more coal than ever before, and most of it's brown coal, so it's creating huge problems. They're actually increasing the situation that they're increasing what they put into the air in terms of carbon and emissions. And I'm curious, I see a lot of this. I see an almost unintended backlash that's created new and exciting problems in attempting to move forward too quickly to unsustainable systems. They have the highest utility cost in Europe, three times higher than any of their neighbors, and it's becoming a huge issue. And right now, of course, all big heavy industry is exempt, and they're talking about, you know, moving more of the onus onto heavy industry, and of course, industry's completely opposed to it. But consumers can only absorb so much of it.
And all right, and we're going to leave it there and get our guests in on this, Joseph. But thank you for bringing that up. Is it, do you think, Paul, one step forward, two steps back thing as new technologies are adapted?
The energy system's filled with contradictions, and I think the caller's dead on, right? A headlong rush into certain kinds of specialized technologies, which before we have really good ways of storing energy. We're still working on batteries. I mean, unbelievably, there's work at the University of Wisconsin still trying to come up with really high capture rates in batteries, and that's exactly the problem with something like wind or solar power. So here we have Germany burning coal. In the United States, the natural gas boom, which is really a boon. If it offsets coal, which it has, it actually means a reduction in greenhouse gases net in the United States. But the contradiction is the price of natural gas is so low that now renewables can't compete, or they can't compete as well as they could prior to the natural gas boom. So the economy is filled with these contradictions, and we're just going to have to work through them before we run headlong into any one single silver bullet solution. So, you know, there's an argument that all of the above makes a certain amount of sense, and I think as a general principle, that's probably true, and I think the caller's story defends that notion.
Paul, let's talk to you more about Wisconsin in particular. What sorts of changes are environmentalists working on, specifically as regards the idea of the Anthropocene era? What challenges does Wisconsin face?
Well, I could give you an example of something Wisconsin's doing right, and if you unpack it, we can think about what other successes might look like. There's a company, the Lime Timber Company, which has a holding of something like 45,000 acres in northern Wisconsin, and they're harvesting timber, right? They're employing, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people directly or indirectly, and they're doing what Wisconsin's always done. They're harvesting timber, but they're doing it in a really different way. They've got a set of easements on the land which forbid them from subdividing the land, which is exactly what happens. You subdivide the land off when it becomes profitable, and you wind up paving it over, essentially, and destroying not only forests but biodiversity, places people can both work and play. And in these easements, you have logging, but you also have public access in perpetuity. So you have snowmobilers, you have people being able to walk into about a dozen lakes, and you got habitat for Canada lynx. Now that's clever, and that's 45,000 acres. And this gets reproduced in a lot of other cases. So I think environmentalism's movement towards easement, which means working with landowners and people who believe that having land in production is still a good idea, that's a terrific innovation, and it's quite old. It's decades old, but Wisconsin's has lots of successes. I think that's very exciting. What does that tell us? I think it tells us that Anthropocene thinking, that instead of throwing everybody off the land as the environmentalist solution, which is both impractical and a political non-starter, you think about working with the system you have. That's a Wisconsin example. Another one I love is the biodigester, the solid biodigester that they built at UW-Oshkosh, or it was built actually at Oshkosh by the foundation there. This thing eats food waste. I mean, the best thing to do with food waste would be to feed people, but they're selling energy back to the grid with this thing and having scholarships, you know, for students. My point there is you're working with a system that you have, food waste that you can't get rid of, that Walmart's just going to throw into the garbage. And it's going to compost away and create greenhouse gases. And instead, somebody got the clever idea to make energy. Wisconsin's got a lot of this innovation going on.
So some pretty intriguing stuff going on right here in Wisconsin. And in our last couple of minutes, Earl and Paul, actually, both of you members of the Breakthrough Institute, which essentially says environmentalism as we know it has run its course and that we need a new path. What does that path look like? Earl, let's start with you.
Well, I think one of the fundamental elements to the breakthrough vision is this idea that just looking to the past as kind of the opportunity for engaging in better conservation and improving things for people has really run its course, like you said, and that really to be forward-looking about what we can do with the environment and better opportunities for humanity is bring those two things together. Instead of the idea that protecting the environment is basically about stopping people from doing what they need to do, it's more about essentially the opportunities, the synergies that come from both improving people's social welfare, at the same time we can improve the welfare of non-human nature. So bringing those things together, I think, is a big part of that vision.
Okay, and Paul, we've got about 30 seconds for you. What would you say?
I think the other part of the breakthrough message is that most of the people who matter in this question don't live in the United States. There are billions of people abroad, hundreds of millions of them sub-Saharan Africa who don't have light. How are they going to get that light? That's the question. And is it going to be through some kind of innovation that's sustainable? Is it going to be coal? Or is our position that we're going to leave them in the dark? And I think that's the urgent question. The decisions made in China and Africa matter most.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Earl, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Paul, wonderful to have you.
Thanks. A real pleasure.
We've been speaking with Paul Robbins, director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and Earl Ellis, associate professor of geography and environmental systems at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And Earl will be coming to Wisconsin on April 22nd to speak at the Nelson Institute for Earth Day.